Last time I was discussing these equations, just the equations for the matter inside the cosmology, and I derived the following equation. So remember, we parameterized the metric with the lapse, shift, and spatial metric. And then I derived these equations, where E is the energy density, K was the trace of the extrinsic curvature, and that's the divergence of the normals. Remember, Kij was dinj. And so if you imagine if you take the trace, it's just div n. And so obviously, if the normals are diverging, the space is expanding. If the normals are converging, it's contracting. And so k is the, if you like, the expansion or contraction rate of the universe. And these equations are completely general, right? This has nothing to do with FRW cosmology. These are the complete equations in any situation. So that was the equation with a zero index. Okay, so that gives you the equation of energy. The rate of change of energy density, E, is basically the divergence of the momentum flux, which is J. So for example, in electromagnetism, this equation would give you the pointing flux, the rate of change of electromagnetic energy in some region. This J would be the pointing vector. And then if we take the same equation, but with the index I, this gives us ji dot plus nkjk plus nk comma ijk equals nkji. Okay, so these are equations 11 and 12 in Bardeen. Now, I showed you a little trick to shorten the derivation of these equations. And the trick was to get rid of ni, okay, the shift. So what I argued is that you can always choose coordinates in which ni is 0. And the way you do that is very simple. You pick some time slicing. Okay, for example, choose this globally increasing function of time, the function that increases in all future light cones. So you pick this increasing function of time. And then you define the spatial coordinates to run along the level sets of the time function. And those sets are automatically perpendicular to the gradient of that function. And the gradient points in the direction normal to the spatial hypersurfaces. If you pick that coordinates like that, ni is automatically 0. And I showed you that last time. So there's no loss of generality in describing a space-time just by picking a coordinate like that. Okay, so ni is 0. And now then the derivations become much simpler because these terms, these messy terms, are all gone. You can just calculate all the Christoffel symbols and work this out. Now, of course, what you'll get is these equations without the nk's in them. Okay? And so now you want to put back the nk's. I want to go back to a general coordinate system. So this is how you do it. First of all, you imagine you've got some general metric. Okay? and you explicitly do the coordinate transformation to get rid of this. So this is the coordinate system. The new, because, you know, when you change from a metric to a new metric, you have these dx, dx primes in there. So the easiest way to do it is to define what the partial derivative of x, the old coordinate, is with respect to the new coordinate. Okay? So here's the old spacetime coordinates, t and xi, expressed in terms of the new ones. And the only non-trivial term is this one, that I shift my old coordinates by this quantity, which is the time integral of ni. So that's a perfectly well-defined, t prime in there. That's a well-defined integral. You'll notice a little bit ambiguous because I haven't told you what the lower limit is. That just means that this whole process is arbitrary up to some integration constant. In fact, it would be an arbitrary function of x, because if this is some lower limit, time lower limit, then that lower limit will give you some definite function of x. So that's just saying that my x is xi prime plus some arbitrary function of x, xi prime. But that's just a spatial coordinate transformation, and it's actually rather trivial. So just ignore that and leave it as this expression with the lower limit undefined. And now just work through as an exercise. Go and calculate all these things, all right? And what you'll find is that miraculously, the ni cancels with the terms from here. You can see it's going to be quadratic in n, right? Because I'm going to get something like I'm going to get dx dt here. These are mu and nu, and this is alpha beta of x. So when I calculate g naught naught prime, I've got two times down here, dt prime. That'll differentiate the upper limit of the integral. That'll give me an ni, so I get my ni squared. So just work through the algebra, and what you'll discover is that g naught naught is just n squared, so the ni is gone. G naught I is 0, so the ni is gone. And the spatial one is not equal to the original spatial metric, this h, but it's equal to it up to a spatial coordinate transformation. Okay? And that's actually rather a trivial thing. So in other words, all you've done is reparameterize your surfaces sigma spatially. Okay? Now, if you think what I did when I derived these equations, I set nk0, and then I had the right-hand side in a form which is automatically covariant under spatial coordinate transformations, right? So the fact that I did this transformation wouldn't alter this side at all. This is a scalar, so it wouldn't change at all, okay? So basically, I can derive it without this term, and then do the inverse coordinate transformation to go back to this full metric. And all that coordinate transformation will do is introduce this term. Okay, so that's a kind of shortcut to calculating this in the general case. And this is exactly the same. Okay, it's a little bit more complicated, as I mentioned, because this isn't just a time derivative. This we could easily understand is a sort of covariant derivative like this. So you can see this is the coordinate invariant form, and that tells you how to put back the nk's. This one is a little more complicated to derive, but I'll give you another little exercise, which is to show the following, that particular quantity is rather a special quantity. You see, I've left an index off somewhere. An index of j. ji, comma, k. This particular combination of a covariant vector and a contravariant vector with one derivative is actually independent of Christoffel symbols. Okay, so just leave that as an exercise, that this is in fact equal to nkji semicolon k plus nk semicolon I jk. Okay, basically because the semicolon means you have a Christoffel symbol, but a derivative on a contravariant index gives a minus Christoffel symbol, derivative on a covariant index gives a plus Christoffel, and they cancel. Okay, so that's sort of why this case works out. I'm not going to work it out in detail. It's just a lot of algebra. Okay, so these are very, very powerful equations. Let me just emphasize, these equations describe anything to do with matter in a curved space-time. Okay, so you can use this for studying accretion disks around black holes or neutron stars or whatever you're doing, or cosmology. Okay, so now I should have left a bit of space, but I will just erase this part. Okay, so now let's do cosmological perturbations. And so the energy density we set equal to E naught plus epsilon. Again, this is following Bardeen's crazy notation. And you'll remember that the background cosmology will be something, will obey these equations, that the Hubble constant squared is 8 pi g over 3 E naught. Okay, because E naught is the unperturbed density, homogeneous density. And then we have the k, which I think he calls c over a squared. Okay, and then we also have for E naught the equation that this would be rho dot is minus 3hp plus rho, which I'm sure you've seen in cosmology. Is that right? You've seen this equation, that rho dot is minus 3hp plus rho. Right. So that, in his notation, is E naught dot is minus 3h E naught plus, and then the pressure he calls pi naught, just to be difficult. Okay, so that's the background. Now we're going to do a perturbed universe, so we'll set E equals to E naught plus epsilon. That's the density perturbation, and this depends on time and space, right? E naught only depends on time. It's completely homogeneous. Okay, so the picture is you have some density in the universe, a mean density, and this will be the perturbation. And you'll want to choose this perturbation so that its spatial average is zero. Okay, so if I plot the density of the universe against space, then it'll be something like that. There'll be waves of density against one coordinate, because really a three-dimensional function. And then E naught is just the mean density. Um, Okay, and then we're going to have this momentum current, Ji. Remember, it came from T naught I. It was basically T mu nu contracted with an N mu, which is the time-like vector, and a projection matrix, which sticks you into the spatial directions. So this is basically T naught I. We'll set that equal to the gradient of some function psi. So Ji is zero in the background. There's no momentum flux. The T naught I is zero in FRW cosmology. Okay, so in the background, this is zero. This is the perturbation. So this is, so all you have is the perturbation in Ji. And what you're saying is, I've got a vector. Well, a vector can always be written as the divergence of a scalar plus the curl of another vector. Okay? So, vector equals, gradient plus curl, I mean. Gradient plus curl. And we're just going to ignore that part, ignore the curl part of it. Because it will turn out, if you study it separately, that curl velocities which are circulating in the universe, actually redshift away as the universe expands. They're not the growing mode perturbation. It's kind of intuitively reasonable, because if you imagine some stuff circulating in the universe, but the universe is expanding, right? Since angular momentum is conserved, as this size of this object grows, the velocity's got to go inversely with the size. And so curl velocities just get wiped out as the universe expands. People study them from time to time to see if they might make magnetic fields or whatever, but in general, they're, in kind of standard scenarios, they're completely unimportant. So the gradient part of the vector is the important one for density perturbation growth. And here we've just taken the Ji to be the gradient of some scalar. And then similarly with the spatial stresses, the Tij components, obviously we have the pressure and, he called this P naught, not pi naught. He calls this P naught. The FRW sort of piece of the pressure, and then pi is the perturbation, and that is delta ij, so here's the perturbation. So that is the that's the perturbation to the isotropic part of Sij, right? Because this delta ij is an isotropic tensor. If I change if I do a rotation, delta ij remains invariant. And so that's the isotropic part of the spatial stresses. So this is to the isotropic part of Sij. And then there's an anisotropic part. And the anisotropic part is just defined to have zero trace. So this looks like this. It's really kind of more technical, and we won't actually use it. But you should be aware it exists. Sigma. And so this part here, this is called the anisotropic stress. You can see that if I take the trace of it, it's zero, because the trace gives me box. The trace of delta ij gives me 3, which cancels that 3. So the trace is zero. And it's also taken to be a scalar. So it's also the scalar part thereof. in full generality, if I've got some tensor here, I also have a piece which is the gradient of a vector, or I have a piece which is a genuine tensor and can't be written as the gradient of a scalar or gradient of a vector. And that last piece actually describes gravitational waves. Those are the really tensor part of the part that sources gravitational waves is the tensor part of the source. But I'm not going to deal with those. And we're going to be taking a perfect fluid for which this is zero. So I think I'm going to have to wipe these out, unfortunately. I'll try and work over here. I told you I hadn't lectured for a while. Not very well organized. Okay, I want to leave them up. So for a perfect fluid, this is zero for perfect fluid. Okay, so why is it zero? Well, a perfect fluid is just characterized by the density at each point and the pressure at each point. And of course, it can move around in space, but it doesn't have any anisotropic stress. When you sit at some point, there's no preferred direction in a perfect fluid, if it's at rest. Okay, so you can have density, pressure, and motion, and that's it. If you sit at some point moving with the fluid, it looks the same in all directions. A perfect fluids are isotropic. What is anisotropic stress? Actually, anisotropic stress is very important. What makes this table move? Okay, when I move the table, it's exactly anisotropic stress, right? Because I'm pushing in a particular direction. And so if you ask, what's the momentum of the table? Well, the momentum is the T naught I integrated over space. And the time derivative is di tij, or dj tij. And so if it moves in some particular direction, there has to have been an anisotropic tij which pushed it in that direction. So anisotropic stresses are very important in general, but they are zero inside a perfect fluid. Okay, so now what we will do is basically stick these equations where, I don't know if we have other colored chalk. No, apparently not. These quantities here are first order in the perturbation. Okay, epsilon, psi, and pi. And so we'll just substitute this into those equations. The zeroth order piece will be zero automatically. The zeroth order piece for the energy will just give this equation. And then the first order piece will give the following equation. So I'll just write them down, and then we will justify that. So first order perturbations, equations. Yay. Okay. All right. So the first order pieces are this, this, and this, and this. Okay, but we're going to take sigma to be zero. So when we plug them in, we'll get this equation, epsilon dot over n naught. That is going to come from here. You see the n I'll replace by n naught because that will be the background quantity. So that's really n naught times 1 plus alpha. But if I expanded it out in a series in alpha, it would give me some term linearly in alpha. That would multiply the epsilon, and I'm already at first order in epsilon, so I don't want to keep that that term. So we'll just get these equations, and I'll kind of check a few terms in a moment. A naught plus P naught, K minus 3 H alpha minus box psi. And then the momentum equation gives us psi dot over n naught equals minus 3h psi minus e naught plus p naught alpha minus pi minus 2/3 box plus 3c over a squared sigma. Okay, so this is still in full generality. And now I can get rid of these guys. Oh, except I wanted to show you the terms. I wanted to show you how some of these terms come about. This was E dot plus NK DK E. Now, if you look at this term, N is first order, because the NK is zero in the background, right? So NK must be first order. But the gradient of E is also first order, because E is E naught plus epsilon. The gradient of this is zero. Gradient only comes from here. So this is second order, so you can just drop that. Okay? So basically, we're left with epsilon dot at first order. And then we had this KE plus KIJ Sij. And so you see here I'm going to get k epsilon. But if you remember, k is minus 3h. K is minus 3 times the Hubble constant. So that was the negative of the rate of increase of the volume. Okay, so that gives me the 3h. And this gives me the epsilon. The Sij has a delta ij pi in it. And so this will give me, again, k times pi. And so that's minus 3h times pi. So that's this term. And then where do I get? Then I've got to worry about this. No, sorry. I'm in the energy equation. I've got to get. Yes, so then I can. So here I've got minus 3h, but of course I've got minus 3h. Plus small k. This is the perturbation in k. Big k. Okay, so I hope you can distinguish my small k's from my big k's. First order. So we have to take the first order perturbation of k, okay, times e naught. And from here, the first order perturbation of kij times Sij. So let me derive those in a second. But that basically gives you this term. And then you have to be careful, because there was a 1 over n here. So that really was an n naught times 1 plus alpha. The alpha multiplies through and gives you this term here. And finally, the divergence of j gives you the grad, the box psi. Okay, so this is the algebra is quite straightforward for that equation. Now let me just give you a few other definitions that allow you to get everything else. By definition, n is n naught times 1 plus alpha. This is, again, first order. And it's, again, a function of t and x, not just t. Ni is a squared di beta. So again, we're just assuming that this vector is the gradient of a scalar. And we're dropping the curl part. And then we're taking the spatial metric to be a squared. So this is the FRW piece, 1 plus 2 phi Fij plus 2 di dj gamma. So this is a three-sphere, three-hyperboloid, or just Euclidean 3 metric, that Fij, that's your space of maximal symmetry. Okay, so A squared Fij is the zeroth order FRW metric. And then again, this is the first order perturbation, and this as well. Okay, so alpha is defined up here. It enters into this equation. Likewise, it'll enter into the psi equation in the same way. I need to define this. Need to calculate pi. So and okay, these are just some definitions. I'm sorry, there's so many variables. Gamma dot plus beta. So this is some variable that's useful to define. I can't really justify it better than that. And k, so the extrinsic curvature is minus 3h plus little k. Okay, and when you calculate little k, you will find minus 3 phi dot over n naught minus h alpha minus box chi. So I think I've defined everything. Oh, there's one little trick you need to get this last term here, and that is to notice that where it comes from is an expression like this, divergence of di dk sigma. And I think Param has already been through the algebra here. You basically use the fact that the commutator of two covariant derivatives gives you the Riemann tensor. And so this is just equal to, I can shuffle these indices like that, and then I get a Ricci tensor dk sigma. And for FRW, RIK is just 2C over A squared FIK. So if you do that, you'll get the 2C over A squared sigma. Okay, so that's just algebra. And we're now almost ready to derive something interesting. And so to do this, I'm going to pick the simplest gauge. Those are completely gauge invariant, right? Those are the full GR equations, which are coordinate invariant or gauge invariant. And so these are completely general. And the beauty of this is you can now pick whatever gauge you like to make the problem you're interested in as simple as possible. In particular, I'm going to pick a synchronous gauge. This is always the best gauge. This gauge is always the simplest for the behavior of the matter. For studying the matter. The matter evolution. And so what is synchronous gauge? Well, synchronous gauge is a special class of this time orthogonal gauge I showed you. And synchronous gauge, you just pick n equals 1 and nk equals 0. Okay, so that's great because now this metric is just hij, and there's only one up here. So the metric here is just minus dt squared plus hij dx I dxj. That's the metric, the full 4D metric in synchronous gauge. To show you can prove that gauge is a little, you can always, to show you can always choose that gauge is a little exercise, which I'll leave and we maybe discuss this afternoon in the problem session. So I'll just leave this x show SG exists. Pictorially, it's very easy to describe what it means. You pick some spatial hypersurface, and it can be anything, any space-like surface, completely arbitrary. So synchronous gauge is not a completely gauge-fixed gauge. It's not unique. There are infinite number of synchronous gauges, okay, defined by whatever spatial slice you chose. So you just choose this, arbitrary. And you just pick one of them, okay? So somewhere in my 4D space-time, I draw a spatial surface. That's it. Then what I say is, let me put a bunch of clocks on that surface. Okay, so I just distribute these clocks, and I let them go. And clocks follow world lines, so every clock will follow some world line. I should have said one other thing. So these are clocks at rest on sigma. So you pick them so they are not moving with respect to sigma. And what that means is that their four velocity is orthogonal. The clock four velocity is orthogonal to any tangent vector lying in sigma. Okay? And then the clocks each have a time, and that's your time coordinate. Okay? And the spatial coordinate is the initial coordinate of the clock. Okay, so what I do is I'm trying to assign coordinates to some point P up here. How do I do that? Well, I just wait for the appropriate clock to hit the point P. And then the spatial coordinate of P is the initial spatial coordinate of my clock on sigma. And the time at P is the time measured by the clock at P. Okay, that's synchronous gauge. And then it's a simple exercise to show that this set of coordinates has this property, that the lapse is 1 and the shift is 0. Any questions about that? Okay, I'll show you. I'll leave it as an exercise. I'll kind of give you some clues for this afternoon to show that this is true. Can anyone see a problem with these coordinates? What's wrong with synchronous gauge? Why don't we always just use synchronous gauge? Why don't we just forget about general coordinate invariance and just use synchronous gauge? Make life a lot easier.
But you could imagine perhaps you might deal with cosmologies in which the hypersurfaces are not centered.
Yeah, so a perturbed universe, you know, as I said, you could pick this thing arbitrarily. Still okay, but the problem is that this coordinate system goes singular. I mean, that's the only problem with any coordinate system, is when it goes singular. Can you see when this is going to go singular? Pardon?
Divergence is negative.
When the k is negative, so that means it's expanding.
Oh, sorry, depends on
in convention. Yes, if k is positive, then the normal vectors are converging. Now, what's the danger there? So what? Still okay. I can still assign points, coordinates.
But we will get coordinate singularity, which is not a natural singularity.
When will I get a coordinate singularity? When they cross. Yeah. Okay. So if the world lines of my clocks collide, okay, then there's no unique coordinate at that point, because there are different spatial axes and maybe different proper times coincide with the same, identify the same point. So then the coordinate system is singular. It's not a one-to-one map from a space-time point to a coordinate. Yeah.
So those like lines of clocks are geodesic, right?
Yes. Sorry, I should have said that. Yes. They follow geodesics.
Okay.
I've defined my clocks to be just particles initially at rest, and I let them go, and they just follow geodesics.
But not actually a problem, because you can have a point with there are many geodesics to any point.
That's right. So in general, it's a bad coordinate system because it goes singular, okay? But it will always do that a finite distance away from your surface. And if you're doing linear perturbation theory, then you're starting from a surface that is, say, an FRW surface that's exactly flat, right? So this would be my T equals constant surface in FRW, and it's completely uniform as a function of space. But when I perturb, I'm going to give some small perturbation. But if I'm working to linear order in the perturbations, then there's no danger of this. Okay? Because I can basically, formally, you can take this linearized amplitude as small as you like. And as you take this amplitude as small as you like, you never have this problem. This is only something that happens at higher than linear. So formally, synchronous gauge is always fine. It's never any problem. And all gauges, in fact, all linearized gauges are as good as any other linearized gauge. But you would not want to study the formation of a galaxy in synchronous gauge. It would just be a total disaster, right? Because you have all these particles flying in and circulating around each other, and your synchronous coordinates would be completely singular, even if the real space-time has no singularities at all, but your coordinates are a disaster. So the moral is don't follow synchronous into nonlinear. You need to change gauge in order to go into the nonlinear regime. Okay, but let's plow on, and we'll choose synchronous gauge. And so that means that alpha, which was the perturbation to N is 0, and in fact, I'm going to choose a slight generalization, a trivial generalization, which is to say N equals N naught of T, just because I like having this N naught around. It's only a function of T. It's rather a trivial thing. And so then we're going to have ds squared equal to minus N naught squared of T dt squared plus hij dx I dxj. This will allow us, for example, to go from one time coordinate, like proper time, to conformal time with no cost of algebra. So I prefer to actually leave that in. Okay, so then we define in synchronous gauge, you say hij is a squared fij. And we will just consider this perturbation of the spatial metric to be delta hij. And so this is my own notation, because Bardeen doesn't really use synchronous gauge, but delta HII. So I'm kind of using a combination of his notation and conventional notation. So I'm just saying that the linear perturbation to the metric is something first order. So that includes these two terms I told you before, the whatever we call them, phi, 2 phi Fij and 2 Digj gamma. And then we have delta I, delta H II, and the index is raised with Fij. Actually, with Fij. Yes. That's another confusing thing, is when you use the A squared or not. And I'm going to just raise it with the convention for this H in the literature for synchronous gauge is just to raise it with this, with Fij. And just to warn you, in the literature, delta Hij is called Hij. But because we've already used Hij for the three metric, and I'm talking about the first order perturbation, I've got to put a delta in front of it. Okay. All right. So we're going to take these equations and work out what they are in synchronous gauge. And so alpha is going to disappear, which is nice. And I'm actually going to take an ideal gas, so sigma will disappear. And this kappa will turn into something simple. So let us go ahead and calculate what my delta H is. So delta H, as I told you, it depended on that phi and gamma from the metric, so you can just work that out. It's twice times 3 phi plus dc gamma. And so what is dc? Well, the covariant box is defined to be hij di dj h background ij. And that was a a to the minus 2 fij. And so this is a to the minus 2 times the box C. Okay, box C is just this guy. It's the co-moving Laplacian. Okay, so I'm going to use this co-moving Laplacian. It makes the algebra a little bit easier. So you see that in this expression, it's only the co-moving Laplacian which appears. There's no A squared. And we can work out the perturbation to the extrinsic curvature. And that turns out to be minus 3 phi dot over n naught minus del c gamma dot over n naught. And this is something nice and simple, minus delta h dot over 2 n naught. Okay, so here I'm just using the formulae for the extrinsic curvature. I think Param already worked out what is the perturbation in the extrinsic curvature. Essentially, it's hij dot, and so you get these terms. And so it turns out the extrinsic curvature is just exactly minus delta h dot over 2 n naught. And so now we can go ahead and so if I call this equation P1 and this equation P2, our two perturbation equations, then P1 becomes, I need to tell you another piece of notation. So we're going to define E is E naught plus epsilon, P is P naught plus pi. If we take an ideal gas, or actually, let's say it more generally. Perfect fluid. So what is a perfect fluid? It has zero anisotropic stress. It has pressure being some function of the density. That's the equation of state for the gas. And so what we do is define the ratio of pressure to density to be omega. And we define the derivative of pressure with respect to density to be the speed of sound squared. So basically, you should imagine this curve, pressure against density, as some curve like that. And so for the background, P and rho will lie on this curve. For example, radiation has P equals 1/3 rho, and cold dark matter has zero pressure. But when you consider the perturbations, you're perturbing delta P and you're perturbing P and rho, so delta P and delta rho are related, and that is to do with the slope of this curve. So the ratio of P over rho is omega, and the slope of the curve is the speed of sound, and that it's called the speed of sound squared because it governs the propagation of small perturbations through the fluid. And so in particular, you see that delta P is CS squared delta rho, or pi is CS squared times epsilon. Okay, so now we can go back to P1, and P1 gives us this equation that epsilon dot over N naught is equal to minus 3H 1 plus CS squared epsilon plus P naught plus rho naught K minus box psi. And psi dot over N naught is equal to minus 3H psi minus CS squared epsilon. Okay, so things are beginning to simplify. And now I'm going to just give you some definitions. Let theta be equal to the covariant derivative of, sorry, the comoving box of psi over E plus P naught A squared. Sorry, A, just one factor of A. And delta be the fractional energy perturbation. So that's E, energy density perturbation. E epsilon over E naught. Okay, so this is a dimensionless perturbation. It basically measures what's the fractional perturbation in the energy density. And I'm just choosing this notation to simplify the final result. We're going to use the background equations. E naught dot is equal to minus 3H E naught plus P naught. We're going to use P naught dot is equal to CS squared E naught dot. Okay, because this is dP is CS squared dE, and I just divided by dT in that equation. And when you do that, you will obtain the following equation. Oh, we're going to also use we're going to set n naught equals to a, that is conformal time. So the metric, the four metric is going to be it's going to be a squared times minus dt squared plus hij. No, plus, sorry, fij plus, I called it delta hij, I think. Okay, let me write this out. Ds squared is a squared times minus dt squared plus fij plus delta hij dxi dxj. Okay, so the point of picking n naught equals a is just to pull the a out of the whole thing. And so this time here is now called conformal time. It's the time coordinate in which the metric is conformal to this. Conformal just means multiplied by a factor. Yep.
Check in your boxed equation on the top.
Yep.
Is the rho naught the same as the e naught?
Mm-hmm. Oh, did I put rho naught somewhere?
In the box equation here on the top line.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Old habits die hard. Okay, sorry. That should be e naught. Okay, so I will just tell you the answer, because now it's just algebra, and you can check that. Maybe this is one of the things you can check in the this afternoon. I want to make one more definition, that the Hubble constant, which is a dot over a n naught, right, is actually a dot over a squared in conformal time. And so we define that to be 1 over a times curly h, and curly h is a dot over a in conformal time. Okay, so basically the point of all this is to get rid of nasty factors of a, and the end result of these manipulations is that delta dot is 3 curly h times cs squared minus omega delta minus h dot over 2 1 plus omega minus 1 plus omega theta, and then we have theta dot is equal to minus curly h 1 minus 3 cs squared theta minus cs squared over 1 plus w box co-moving delta. Okay, so those are the synchronous gauge perturbation equations for a perfect fluid. And you'll see kind of nice features about them, that essentially there are only three quantities. One is delta, the fractional perturbation of the density, theta, which is essentially the divergence of the velocity. Remember that grad psi was the momentum, and theta is the divergence of that. So theta is basically divergence of V. And so delta is delta rho over rho. Theta is div v, and then we have h, which was, well, in fact, we have h dot, sorry, that should be a delta h. Then we have delta h, then we have kappa, this little k, the perturbation to the extrinsic curvature, which is delta h dot over 2 n naught. So the trace of the metric perturbation enters into the equation as well. And so all of these terms have kind of simple interpretations. This term in particular has a very simple physical interpretation, and I'll show you that by considering two cases. So let's do those cases. Let's do radiation. So for radiation, P is 1/3 rho. So this equation of state is just linear, and so we get omega equals CS squared. Sorry, sometimes I call this omega and sometimes W. Maybe I'll stick to W. W is 1/3. And so for radiation, you can read off here that delta dot is minus, this is 0. This is 2/3 delta h dot. And then we have minus 4/3 theta. And theta dot is, again, that first term is 0. Minus, and then 1/3 divided by 4/3 is 1/4 co-moving times delta. Let's check that's right. And for CDM, cold dark matter, omega is CS squared is 0. So that's the simplest case of all. Just dust, just particles that are sitting there with no thermal velocity at all, and they just move along geodesics. But then, of course, they back react on the space-time. They move, and then they perturb the metric. So the change in their density sources the metric perturbation and causes the perturbation to grow in time. So we'll see exactly how that happens. So omega CS squared is 0. So here we get delta dot is equal to minus delta h dot over 2. So that's a really easy equation for CDM. Then there's the theta term, minus theta. And then theta dot is minus h theta. And that's it for CDM. OK, so we've been through a lot of pain. But we end up with very, in simple cases, with very simple equations. Okay, so I've got a couple of minutes left. So let me describe what the physical interpretation of those terms. So let's look at the CDM first. That's the simplest case. So I have this spatial hypersurface, right? And my CDM particles are sitting there alongside my clocks, right? And then I let the universe go, And of course, the CDM particles just, if they were at rest, they just follow the clocks. They just like the clocks. Okay. So what does that mean? You see here, if theta equals 0 initially, if there's no initial divergence of the velocity, if the co-moving velocity of these particles is 0, then it just remains 0 for all time, because theta dot is minus h theta. Okay, so then it remains 0 for all time. And then the first equation is just delta dot is minus h minus delta h dot over 2. And where does this come from? Well, this comes about because the, you see, what from this picture here, as I follow these lines, the volume of space, the proper volume of some element of space is going to change, right? If those lines are converging, space is shrinking, all right? And what measures the shrinkage is h. And so in particular, the volume here will be d3x, some integral, and I'll get the determinant of h. Okay, let's call that the co-moving volume. So forget about A, the co-moving volume. So this is an overall factor of A squared or whatever, or A cubed in the volume. But then this will be the square root of the determinant of delta, Fij plus delta Hij. Now, the determinant of 1 plus a small matrix is 1 plus the trace. Okay, so that will be det f times 1 plus 1 half because of the square root delta h. Okay, so you see the change in the volume is just the fractional change is delta h over 2. And so the change in the density, delta, is just, if the volume is increasing, the density goes down by that factor. And so that's the delta h over 2. It's exactly the same factor. So our coordinates are following the particles, but that doesn't mean the density stays the same, because the volume of space is shrinking, so the density goes up or down. So that's that delta h over 2, and this is 2/3. Why is there 2/3 here? Well, the thing is that a photon in a shrinking or an expanding space has an additional effect. What's the extra effect? If I have a particle, and I measure its energy or the density of a cloud of particles, and space shrinks, right? The density goes up. It's the same mass in a smaller volume. But what about a photon? What does it do when space shrinks or expands? Blue shift or red shift, okay? And so this factor of 2/3 is exactly the 2/3. Remember where it came from. It was 1/2 1 plus W. Okay, that W is the red shifting or blue shifting of the photons. And it's 2/3. Why? Because you get the same half from here, but then you get 1/6. The 1/6 the 1/6 is 1/3 of this factor. Why is it 1/3? Because photons respond to the length, not the volume. Redshift goes, you know, you have a piece of space and it stretches by some length, the wavelength stretches by that length. So photons go like the length, not the volume. The length is volume to the 1/3 power, and that's why you get an extra 1/6 here. Okay, so all of this physics is incorporated into this equation. So the reason why we have this term here for photons is that they have a non-zero pressure. And so they can support a perfect fluid of photons. It's a little bit of a strange thing, this. A perfect fluid of a photon, I just warn you, there's a little bit of a strange thing. But a perfect fluid of photons, providing it remains a perfect fluid, okay, does have pressure and supports acoustic waves. And this term is describing acoustic waves. And in fact, you can see from here that if I ignore the H dot, in this equation. So ignore the expansion, ignore the GR effects. Take this equation and this equation. You'll get delta double dot from the first equation is minus 4/3 theta dot. Minus 4/3 theta dot is plus 1/3, 1/3 del C delta. And if you remember the wave equation, this is CS squared delta C delta. And so the CS squared is 1/3. In other words, this really is the speed of sound squared, because that's a wave equation with a certain speed in it. And the speed is CS squared. Now, I said it's a little bit of a funny thing, because if you just have photons in a metric, they don't remain a fluid. So if I just have photons, imagine I have a bunch of photons, and their density is like this. Here are all my photons. Okay, there's some underdensity in the photons over here. What's going to happen? Well, these photons actually free stream out of the overdense regions. They just move out. That's to say there's a viscosity which is large. They just spread out and they don't behave like a fluid at all. Okay, but in the early universe, you have photons and electrons and baryons, and they actually couple together very strongly. So it does, after all, behave like a perfect fluid. The contribution to the density of the electrons and the baryons is tiny, but nevertheless, their presence is enough to stop the photons moving anywhere. And so it does behave like a perfect fluid. So the early universe is described by these equations, even though the reasons are a little bit complex. Okay, I better stop there. Go ahead.
Sorry, just to make it a little clearer.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking like classically, like if you have Maxwell's equations with, in vacuum, like they're linear, right? So there's no no photon interactions.
That's right.
So there's no, so you can't have like a fluid of photons. I don't know how you describe it thermodynamically, but it clearly can't support acoustically. But
so yeah, it's a kind of a fluid. You would never use a fluid to describe a gas of photons.
Yeah,
it's just a silly description.
Right. It's an ideal gas with no.
It's not even an ideal gas. Really? No. Yeah, because what happens is if remember. The definition of a perfect fluid is, or ideal gas, is that there are no anisotropic stresses. Mm-hmm. Now, if I take a fluid of photons and I make, I take a bunch of photons and I put them in a top hat, you know, so there's zero, nothing outside them, it's just this gas of photons, what happens? They all just go like this. Okay, there's an anisotropic flow of them. And the stress is actually anisotropic.
Isn't that the same though as if you put like a bunch of say hydrogen, like non-interacting hydrogen molecules on top of that? They'll also free stream.
Exactly.
Whatever wealth they're
in. Exactly. So they are not a perfect fluid either.
So you're saying hydrogen non-ideal gas?
Yes.
So what is an ideal gas?
An ideal gas is a subtle thing. But what makes an ideal gas ideal? Or a perfect fluid perfect, is that locally the fluid is isotropic. It's okay. Only characterized by scalar functions, density and pressure. There's no anisotropic stress. Whereas if you take a bunch of hydrogen, in fact, I can tell you that, say I have a gas of particles, and then work out Tij. What is the stress energy? What are the Ij components of the stress energy? It'll turn out it's proportional to sum of all the particles, Pi Pj. This is the momentum of the ith particle. Now this thing is, if all the particles are going like this, definitely anisotropic. Or even if I put them in a top hat and they all go out like this, in this region of space, is totally anisotropic. And so this is definitely not a perfect fluid. It's only when you put the interactions in, it becomes a perfect fluid. So there's this sort of funny contradiction that the easiest regime to analyze a fluid is when there are enough interactions to make it perfect, but the actual energy in the interactions is very small, so I can ignore it. So you treat it as free particles, as far as its energy and pressure and all the other quantities go. But the interactions are essential to basically allow it to equilibrate locally. So that's the real thing, is that what's happening is that the interactions are making this fluid equilibrate locally. So it's only characterized by a temperature and a velocity. That's what the interactions do. But the actual energy in the interactions should be negligible.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'd like to photon fluid, we'd like to think of photons like that interact with each other slightly. So should we think of, like, is there a way to think of this as like an effective theory where the photons have interactions mediated by protons and electrons, and then you like take those vertices to zero?
Yes, probably there is. I mean, those are all the ingredients. You have a bunch of photons, and you put in enough electrons that they will cause the photons to equilibrate, to isotropize. So basically, you have a few electrons. So a photon moving along will hit the electron and then scatter in some random direction, and that will isotropize the phase-based density of the photons. So I just want to point out that subtlety. But next time we will analyze these equations, and basically we'll need one more equation because these are two equations for three unknowns. We've got delta, theta, and delta H, and I've got two equations, so I need another equation. So it turns out I need one of the Einstein equations. And one of the Einstein equations will give me the H, evolution of the metric. And then I'll have three equations, and I can solve these things to figure out what a universe full of radiation, or CDM, does. When we do that, we'll understand how perturbations grow in the universe. And then we'll get to the Zeldovich spectrum and the conventional description of density variations in cosmology. You can already see the effect of this term, the box C on the photons. It means there are acoustic waves. I've just derived a wave equation. So it means this photon-electron fluid will support waves. And those waves are exactly responsible for the oscillations in the microwave background. So when we plot, you've seen these curves of CL versus L. Okay, these oscillations are directly a consequence of that term. Okay, basically the universe is full of these oscillating waves, and we see a snapshot of it at one time. And we'll see waves of this wavelength at their maximum, this wavelength at their zero, okay, when they're actually oscillating up and down, and so on. So it's this term which directly gives the oscillations. Okay, so see you tomorrow. Are there any last-minute questions? I guess I will come by this afternoon. I'm not sure if you're going to have a problem class this afternoon. What time? 2:30. Okay, so I'll come by at 2:30. And I was going to set as a problem to show that synchronous gauge always exists. By the way, synchronous gauge is also relevant for something called Harava-Lifshitz gravity that you may have heard about. This is some new approach to quantum gravity that splits time and space. Okay? And this whole discussion of essentially reducing gravity to just a spatial metric is exactly behind that idea. All of the stuff I'm doing here is actually, even though it's rather painful, it's actually universal. Okay, once you've done it and understood it, then pretty much any field you work in that involves gravity, this will be useful. Okay.